Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to History Hack. We've got a fantastic guest for you yet again on a subject I know absolutely nothing about. So because I know absolutely nothing about, I'm going to hand you over to Zach, who's going to do the introductions. Hello, Zach.
Hi, Bernie, but you're kind of assuming that I know what I'm talking about as well, which
I never assume that.
Not really the case. Okay, Bern, nicely done. Hell of a way to start an episode. Git. No, I love you, Bernie. We're joined by a brilliant guest today, Dr. James Holloway, who has a PhD in archaeology from Cambridge University, no less. He's an expert in the early Middle Ages, but at the moment he's working with something very cool called the History and Games Lab, which is based at Edinburgh. He has a co-authored book out called A Viking in the Sun, but we're not talking about that today. We're talking about something called the Varangian Guard, and I'm going to have to trawl up a little kind of snippet of Crusader knowledge to attempt to vaguely sound like I know what I'm talking about. James, welcome to History Hack. Great to see you. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Shall we start with the basics then? So the Varangian Guard, I mean, you've already had to correct me on my pronunciation off air.
Well, now,
so,
I mean,
what was it?
So I mean, I don't want to be correcting people's pronunciation because, of course, this is not, it's not an English word in the first place, right? So we're all just approximating it. But the Varangian Guard is a, if you read like a book that is not about it, but that's about kind of like the Viking world in general, people will tell you that the Varangian Guard is the Byzantine emperors or the Eastern Roman emperors, right? No one says Byzantine, but you know what I mean? The Roman emperors, the imperial bodyguard. This is a bit romantic. I mean, it's true in a sense that the guard, you know, they do provide security for the emperor, and there are Varangians guarding palaces and other government buildings, but they're out on campaign all over the empire and all over its borders. So it might be more accurate just to say that they're kind of a regiment of the sort of standing central part of the imperial army, and they're made up primarily of people who come from Scandinavia, so from Sweden, probably mainly from Sweden, but also from Norway, Denmark, from Iceland, and also from sort of what are today Russia and Ukraine, so the Kiev and Rus, and maybe from other parts of the world as well. We're not 100% sure.
So let's get down to brass tacks here. What does Varangian actually mean?
Well, okay, that's a complex question. So I hate to say things like, you know, nobody really knows, but like, so the Varangians are a term that people use to refer to, I guess, people from Northern Europe. And it's not always consistently used. So sometimes we see like the terms Varangian and Rus or Rus being used interchangeably. And then at other times, there are like Byzantine sources from the 11th century that say there were Varangians and Rus at this place. So they're clearly thinking that they're two different things. So Varangians may mean something like Scandinavians, but then later on in the, she's writing in the 12th century, but about the 11th century, Anna Komnena says, she says the Varangians are men of the British race. And there are other references to Anglino-Varangoi, English Varangians, because after the Norman conquest, there are a lot of English recruits in the Varangian Guard. Because it's like all of these kind of definitions, it doesn't seem to necessarily stay consistent over time either. And there's this other problem, of course, of I think they call it Atticism in Byzantine history, where Byzantine historians tend to use like classical sounding terms for things to make themselves feel like they're part of the, you know, the Greek historical tradition, even when they're completely like inaccurate to what they're talking about. So for instance, Anacomnena calls the French, you know, people or Normans or whatever on the First Crusade Celts, because they're from Gaul. And so therefore they are Celts. And never you mind that quite a lot of time has passed. So the term is used kind of imprecisely. If you look at medieval Russian sources, I think it's the beginning of the Russian Primary Chronicle that says, you know, that these Varangians are called Rus, but there are other Varangians who are called Angles, Saxons, Normans, Goths, and Danes, for they are thus named, which is the least helpful explanation of a name, because he just says they're called that because that's what they're called. So yeah, it's this name that no one's 100% sure. It may come from a word that means something like people who made an agreement. So it may be something like federati, like in the Roman military. So it may mean allies. So we tend to use the word to mean what, like, colloquially you or I might call Vikings, people from Scandinavia or people from cultures that were in contact with those Scandinavian cultures, you know, but it changes over time, and everybody just says Vikings as a kind of shorthand. But you know, I mean, originally there probably were more. So they come down through Rus. I don't know how much you know about the Kievan Rus, but it's a state in kind of what is today Ukraine and Russia, that may or may not have probably has a sort of Scandinavian element to it, like a Swedish upper class. I mean, these are debated and unclear, but there's definitely some kind of connection there. And in the 10th century, starting in the late 9th century, you start to see large numbers of like Rus mercenaries in the Byzantine military. And probably sometime in the late 10th century, maybe in like the 980s, it's often conventionally dated to a particular campaign during the reign of the Emperor Basil II, but I don't know that we're actually sure about that. I think that's just kind of, you know, what we tend to say. This participation turns into a, you know, a formal agreement that you'll get, that the Byzantine Emperor, that the Roman Emperor will hire kind of soldiers of fortune from this part of the world if they turn up willing to serve. So the creation of like the guard as an institution may be the formalization of a relationship that had already existed for some time. The theory behind having them as the imperial bodyguard. Well, so people will tell you again that it's a bit like if you think about you get this in at some points in you know, in the Roman Empire, in the Western Roman Empire, you get this idea of having outsiders as the imperial bodyguard, on the grounds that they don't have any kind of factional loyalty within the empire. That's the theory, that, you know, they don't have any cousins who might like to be emperor. I don't know if that's true. Byzantine writers are very given to describing the Varangians as intensely loyal to the emperor and not like ever willing to forsake their duty, and they'll lay down their lives to protect him. But actually, like, if you look at the history, there are Varangians on both sides of a number of Byzantine internal conflicts. There are Varangians involved in coups. According to Harald's saga, the Varangians, like at least one Varangian, helps to overthrow an emperor. So I don't know, you know, this may be more kind of propaganda than you know, these deathlessly loyal bodyguards may just be kind of a hype. But it's pretty consistent with the way that the Byzantines often approach those kinds of diplomatic relationships, like trying to turn enemies into assets. So the first appearance of these Rus mercenaries actually comes following a conflict between the Rus and the Romans. And so it may just be that they, you know, if what they're looking for is plunder, then if the Romans hire them, then they can just turn them from a threat into an asset at the same cost. And that's something that you see a lot, that, you know, the Roman armies of this period are very diverse. They're full of, you know, not just troops from the different parts of the empire, but kind of from just wherever they could be found. So I don't know if this is a quality unique to these, you know, loyal Varangian guardsmen, or just that the empire has a lot of money and a lot of prestige, and they you know, they like to solve one problem with another. It's a very very characteristic part of their strategy.
So let's talk about them, and sort of not so much their makeup, but what they're actually doing. I'm getting the impression that this isn't sort of an entirely ceremonial role. These are people with an ability. You're paying for them to do a task, and so therefore you're gonna use them. I also have kind of echoes of part of this, admittedly, might come from computer gaming, so please feel free to laugh at me hysterically if this is idiocy, but that these are kind of almost an elite style unit. These are a better element of the Byzantine army. Is that true, or is that just pop
That's an interesting question. I think I'll split the difference and say that certainly contemporary authors tend to regard them as an elite unit. Right. So, you know, whether they were or not, and we have, you know, we have records of them, you know, winning battles, and we have records of them losing battles, just like anybody else. But they certainly, people tend to think of them as, in particular, as being kind of elite among the infantry available. You know, the elite units within this army are kind of more typically cavalry, but the military tradition of you know, of Northern Europe at this point is sort of mainly on foot, and well, on foot and on and at sea, right? They're also used in kind of naval campaigns, but so yeah, they're the imperial, like the quote unquote imperial bodyguard is just sort of more like the regiments that are directly available to the emperor. I mean, the Varangians themselves, we don't know precisely how many of them there were, but estimates tend to be in the kind of, I think one figure that gets quoted a lot is 4,000. So, you know, they're a pretty substantial fighting force, especially when combined with the other regiments of the Imperial Guard. So the idea, I think, is that when you're putting together a force, you know, you'll recruit whatever troops you can and then kind of stiffen them a bit with whatever you can spare from the central military, almost like a reserve, because they're certainly on campaigns where the emperor is not present. So like one of the for Viking of the Sun, which is about a particular period in the history of the guard, when the future king of Norway, Harald Sigurdsson, was serving in the Varangian guard in the 1030s and early 1040s, the Varangians took part in the Byzantine invasion of Sicily. Which was not, you know, the emperor was not there. So, you know, they weren't guarding his person. They were just sent to go give this, you know, this force that was assembled, you know, some extra punch. And if we are to believe the sources that later generations of Scandinavians wrote about it, then they did very well. Much to the embarrassment of everybody else in the army. If we are to believe the Roman records, they were barely there at all because they're hardly mentioned. This is one of the problems, is that there's not, and we don't know as much as we have to kind of infer a lot of stuff about how they were organized and even who they were. There are, for instance, there are very few cases where Roman sources actually name a Varangian. One of the unusual things about Harald is that there is actually a Roman source that says, they call him Araltes, but it's clearly him. There's a Roman source that says he served in the guard and he was promoted. And there are a few other cases, but it's also not always clear that their leaders are Varangians per se, right? So that they might have Greek commanders. And so in some cases, those names might be the ones that are being recorded. So we don't actually know that much about their kind of composition, but we do know like where they're being deployed, and they're being deployed all over the empire. So like, just to go through my my quick list. So we've got when they start like actually using the term Varangians rather than just saying they're, so they're Rus troops in Syria in the 10th century, in Sicily, in Italy, within the heart of the empire itself, fighting against the rebellion of Vardas Phokas, in Syria again, in Georgia, in Armenia, then in the early 11th century, in fighting the Bulgarians, fighting the revolt of Melo of Bari in the early 11th century. And then, throughout the whole early part of the 11th century, they're everywhere. They're in Sicily again. They're fighting in Georgia in the 1020s. We start to see the description of the Varangians in kind of like the second quarter of the 11th century. So they're fighting in Egypt in the 1030s, in Italy. So in Sicily, as I mentioned, in the late 1030s, early 1040s, in Italy in the early 1040s, they're in Armenia. So like just in the 1040s, they're fighting also in Armenia. They turn up, of course, they're in the Battle of Manzikert, where the emperor is captured from amongst like the ranks of the Varangian Guard by the Seljuk Turks. They turn up in the fighting in what is today Albania in the 1080s. So they're all over the map. They're in every part of the empire. And so you definitely get the sense that like, wherever there's a serious Byzantine, military expedition, if they can spare some Varangians to add to the force, they will. There's also maybe a suggestion that like they often used to kind of garrison places, maybe reflecting their sort of maybe comparative lack of mobility. I don't know about that, but the idea that they were thought of as kind of defensive troops, that's certainly true at Dyrrhachium, where they get where the thing that Anna writes about is that they sort of withstood these enemy charges, right? They're an infantry unit, so they're seen as maybe not as as aggressive, but I could be wrong about that. I don't know, the writing about the heroism of the Varangians is often like about their kind of tenacity and determination, right? This standing and weathering charges kind of stuff. But those are only a handful of examples. Like they turn up in pretty much any conflict that the Byzantines are recorded as participating in. There's some Varangians in there, so they kind of get everywhere.
So there isn't any kind of suggestion that these are shock troops so much as, you're going to put them in the front line to withstand an assault, or you're going to use them as the reserve to hold off the enemy if everything else is going wrong. Is that the sense?
We know so little about when we get detailed descriptions of how the forces are deployed, at Manzikert, for example, they seem to be guarding the emperor, right? It's mentioned that there are Varangians fighting around the emperor, when he is captured. So maybe they're like when the emperor is actually on the field, they do serve as a bodyguard. So they're, you would see them in a primarily defensive role. But on the other hand, the campaign in Sicily is all, there are a couple of field battles, but it's mainly kind of sieges. And the Scandinavian source, well, I say Scandinavian, the Icelandic source, Harald Saga, which talks about, what Harald got up to in Sicily. This is, of course, the same guy who dies at the Battle of Stamford Bridge in 1066. Perhaps best known to English speakers because of that, but he has this whole earlier career in the Mediterranean. And that's all about them, capturing sort of fortified towns. Although the stories are quite fantastical. So I don't know if either of you, or if any of the listeners watch the TV show Vikings, but there's a bit in that show during the siege of Paris where Ragnar fakes his own death. Spoilers for a thing that happened in like the 10th century. Where Ragnar fakes his own death and is taken inside the town And then, you know, oops, he's not dead. He pops up out of his coffin and, you know, captures the place. And that story is in Harald's saga about how Harald took one of these towns in Sicily. It's that the, you know, that they pretend he's dead. And then the locals are like, oh, well, we must have the body of such a great man, you know, to attract like pilgrims to our monastery. At which point you start to think, in Muslim Sicily? I'm not sure about that. And, you know, like the claim of being Saint Olaf's half-brother probably doesn't carry a lot of weight in Muslim Sicily in the 1040s, but never mind. Or the very late 1030s, I guess. But so a lot of these are kind of like fantastical or sort of stock adventure stories. Hard to know exactly what they're being used as. But in, for instance, in the Alexiad, when they talk about the role of the Varangians at the Battle of Dyrrhachium, once again, it's about how they're kind of trying to stand off some charges, or and at times how they get lured out of formation by enemy cavalry. And there's examples of them serving in kind of siege defenses, right? So for instance, in the much later on in the 13th century, there's a garrison of Varangians who defend a city against Bulgarian attackers. So I think there's, you know, there's some other examples of that, but I feel like in a, you know, in an age where sort of the, you know, if you think about they're fighting these whoever, the Aglubids in Sicily or the, I always say it's either the Aglubids or the Calabids, and it turns out to be the other one, but I think it's the Aglubids that are mainly fighting in Sicily, or, you know, the Normans in Italy, or if they're in Syria, or, you know, fighting the Seljuks in Armenia. Those are all opponents that kind of primarily have sort of cavalry focused armies. So I assume that's going to put a heavy infantry unit into a defensive role, because we do know, for instance, they're often referred to as the axe bearing Varangians or the axe bearing guards. And so that distinctive thing that they carry, these big two-handed axes, right, the so-called Danish axes, is kind of their signature weapon, and it is seen as you know, a bit of kind of I'm trying to think of an equivalent. It's sort of it makes them distinctive, because if you look at images of them, they're dressed in more or less typical kind of Byzantine military garb. They don't look like Vikings particularly, other than that they're often portrayed with blonde hair. But then they carry the axes, and yeah. And so that becomes like the symbol of that's what represents a Varangian, is that he has this great big tall axe. You know, it's a little bit like drawing somebody in a kilt, and you're like, oh, that person's meant to be Scottish. You know, it's sort of their signifier. But yeah, so they kind of get everywhere, and they turn up in all kind of eras, right up into the later, the High Middle Ages. But
before we get to that, I've got two quick questions I want to sneak in. How many of them were there? Because, you know, was the Praetorians 5,000 to 8,000 at their peak, say? How many was the Varangians? Were they a big unit, or they were a smaller select lot?
I don't know that the numbers are precise, and it probably is different at different times as well. We know, for example, at the very near the end of the 10th century, we know that Vladimir of Kiev sends 6,000 troops to go help Emperor Basil II. There are other sources that say 4,000 Varangians. There are 3,000 Varangians serving in Armenia in the 1040s, and presumably that's not the entire core. So I've seen a lot of estimates that say 4,000. It's often, there's a reference to Harald bringing 500 men with him when he comes to Constantinople, and it's been suggested that they're divided into like divisions of 500, because you often see them turning up in places in like multiples of 500. But sometimes there are smaller numbers, so there are cases of just like a few hundred Varangians being sent somewhere as well. So I don't think we know exactly, but it's in that range. You know, there's let's say, you know, more than 3,000, but fewer than 10,000 of them, you know, give or take.
Okay, cool. The other bit that you've mentioned, a lot of different sources here, including some, were you saying Anna earlier?
Yeah, Anna Komnena.
Yeah. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that and maybe some of the complexities you've got with digging into these sources?
So Anna Komnena is the daughter of the Emperor Alexius I. She writes a history of her father's reign, the Alexiad. And yeah, I mean, she kind of says the same things about the Varangians. You know, she's not, it's another of those sort of frustrating examples of Anna mentions the Varangians, but doesn't talk about them all that much. But she goes into a little bit of detail. She doesn't just sort of like mention them and assume you know what they are. She does talk about how they're, you know, she calls them the axe bearing barbarians. I think she's the one who says that they come from Thule, you know, like the legendary land in the far north. I think that's Anna. And so, yeah, she now when she's writing about those campaigns of like the 1080s, she's actually talking about things. I forget exactly when she's born, but she certainly wouldn't like remember them. But she did have contact with, you know, I mean, but the emperor, for example, but also other senior figures in the imperial court. So she's a pretty good source. Our main source for the invasion of Sicily is another Byzantine historian, John Skylitzes. And he doesn't mention he talks about the context of the invasion, but he doesn't mention the Varangians participating in it at all. You know, he's talking mainly about the commander of the force, a guy called Georgios Maniakis, and his quarrels with the expedition's naval commander Stephanos, who Maniakis hit after he allowed an enemy commander to escape, which was a bad idea because Stephanos may not have been a great sailor, but he had one very important qualification for the job, which is that he was the emperor's brother-in-law, and that's not the kind of guy you slap. And that's how Maniakis got relieved of command. But if you were to read the account, so there are a lot of Icelandic sagas that mention people serving the Varangian Guard. Like it's in Laxdala Saga. There's a what's called a Fauter, like a short story that's appended to. Oh, dear. Now I've lost it now in my mind, but to one of the other sagas, which is about this guy, Thorstein Dromund, and how he goes and joins the Varangian Guard. And then, of course, there's Harald's saga itself, which in the most common form forms part of the Heimskringla, the sort of history of the kings of Norway. But these are all much later texts. You know, they are recounting things that happened in the sort of so-called Viking Age, but they are from a couple of hundred years afterward. So we have to be a little cautious. I think it's very clear, for instance, that that the accounts of where Harald is in the Mediterranean as part of the Varangian Guard in Harald's saga are out of order. They don't line up with campaigns that that we know were taking place. So I think it's a case of of Snorri Sturluson, the author of Heimskringla, taking incidents that he knew had happened and trying to get them into the correct order, but then also kind of filling in blanks with these kind of stock adventure moments. There are other versions of Harald's saga where like he fights a giant snake. At one point he's in jail and he gets saved by a miracle. So sober history is perhaps, well, I say that's actually pretty much what you'd expect. I was going to say that that's not sober history, but our primary sources for the First Crusade involve miracles, like eyewitness accounts. So that's pretty par for the course in this era. So dealing with the sources it is a challenge because there's no point where someone says, okay, let's sit down and write a guide to the Varangians, you know, who they are and it's clear that the Byzantines don't necessarily know a great deal about them. So the most detailed description of Harald's time in the Varangian Guard that comes from a Greek source is a text attributed to this Byzantine officer, Cacaminos, who was part of the invasion of Sicily. And so he served alongside Harald. He's the guy who calls him Araltes. And he has this whole story about how his father was the king of Varangia, which is obviously not a place that exists. And he understands that Harald's brother was previously king. Like he even, I forget what he calls him. It's like Iolabos or something like that, but it's clearly meant to be Olaf. Like he understands better than most, but still there's a lot of, you know, Harald's father was not the king of Norway. He was only Olaf's half brother and not on the side that was royal. Although his father was a king because Norwegian kingship is very complicated. But most of them don't seem to be very curious about what the, you know, where the Varangians come from or what they're like. They kind of describe them in these very like, stereotyped sort of ways, right? They're brave northern barbarians with their big axes, and they regard loyalty to the emperors as a sacred trust handed down from father to son. And, you know, it's very kind of like, they're positive stereotypes, but they're still stereotypes, right? So it's an interesting sort of, you have to kind of like piece together little bits of, no one writes like a history of the Varangians. So you have to look at like accounts of individual campaigns and do that, or look at the archaeological evidence. So for example, in Sweden, there are lots of runestones that are erected in memory of people who died, who served in the Varangian Guard and then came home and died at a later date, right? But that it's mentioned on their sort of memorial stone. Or there's runic graffiti in Hagia Sophia. So in what was the imperial church in Constantinople, there's a spot where almost certainly what's happened is, you know, one of the emperor's Varangian bodyguards, it's up in this gallery where the emperor would have maybe been watching the services, and someone was just kind of chiseled his name into the, it says Halfdan. He's whiled away the time graffitiing Hagia Sophia, and you can see it there today. Or there's a runic inscription on one of the Arsenal lions that were taken to Venice following the Fourth Crusade. It was a sculpture from Constantinople, and it's got a runic inscription on it. So similarly, you find bits of kind of Scandinavian style material culture in context associated with Byzantine military activity. So, I mean, the evidence is pretty good that they were there, but in terms of the specific details, we don't know. We do get the impression, I mean, everyone seems to agree that this could be extremely profitable. That service in, you know, that the opportunities for plunder, but not to say nothing of the pay. So the pay is good. The opportunities for plunder are good. And there seems to have been a form of ritualized pillaging, which was done when there was a succession. So when a new emperor came to power, he would let the Varangians loot the palace. It's not clear what that's all about, but that it seems to be a kind of a kind of donation that the emperor makes to the Varangians. And through all of this, Harald, who may at one point have been jailed for misappropriating official funds, the saga says that he was jailed because the empress was in love with him, but you know, it would, wouldn't it? Harald may have been, he returned, you know, having gone into exile basically following the defeat of his, or the death of his half brother, King Olaf. You know, having gone into exile, in a pretty poor situation, he returned to Norway, very wealthy and able to, you know, support the kind of forces necessary to broker a deal with his nephew, who had become, had subsequently become. It's complicated, but when he returned, his nephew, Magnus, was running the country, and the combination of Harald's military experience and wealth made him a very persuasive claimant to the throne. So there's a lot of similarly. Bolli Bolason, the guy who comes back in one of the sagas, it describes how beautifully dressed he is, So there's this whole thing that's like, you know, and the like women follow him everywhere, and everybody admires Bali's, you know, amazing outfit and his beautiful sword and his shield with a picture of a knight on it. And so there's some suggestion that this was just, you know, look, if you are, particularly if you're someone like Harald, who's been, who's essentially on the run. And he's been in Rus, where his cousin, Yaroslav the Wise, is in charge. But, this is a good place to go for him. It's a good opportunity to gain valuable experience. He's very young when he arrives. I mean, he's in his very early 20s, maybe not even that. We actually, for the cover of the book, it's got a beautiful cover illustration. The only thing we had to change was that when we got it, when people think of Harald Hardrada, they think of him as the guy from the Battle of Stamford Bridge, right? They think of this, you know, tough, grim old Viking. And we're like, this guy's like 21. We need to young him up a little bit. The rewards were pretty great. The Roman Empire seems to have been held in some kind of respect. Like there's a lot of when Constantinople or when the Byzantine Empire is mentioned in Scandinavian sources, there's this kind of sense that it's, you know, that it has this prestige, even kind of over and above its material wealth, because it's the capital of the empire. It's, it's pretty great that you have gone there. And of course, while you're there, you can also Harald went to the Holy Land, and he swam in the Jordan, and you know, did all the other kind of like pilgrimage things that you're supposed to do, which is also, reinforcing his claim to the throne, right? Because a lot of his prestige rests on his association with his saintly half brother. So going to the Mediterranean and getting to, visit all these Christian holy sites is a great way to kind of boost your credibility among Christian supporters as well.
So we've covered sort of the early phase of them. What happens as we kind of move into the Middle Ages? I have a vague memory rattling around the back of my head that they're at the Fourth Crusade's siege of Constantinople.
They are, yeah.
And I've probably got this completely wrong in my head, but I've got a feeling that they sort of look at the situation and go, yeah, no thanks. We don't really fancy this.
There are recorded, like there are Varangians among the defenders of Constantinople, but at the same time, and they actually stick around even after when the Fourth Crusade takes Constantinople, you get the formation of these kind of Byzantine splinter states. In Epirus and Nicaea, there are Varangians in the militaries of both kind of post-Byzantine states. So there are units called Varangians. There's, you know, it gets a little more complicated in the later part of the period. Yeah, so we know that in the, like, even into the we know that in the 13th century there are Varangians in the Byzantine military, but they seem to no longer, like, they turn up less frequently in the records. I think maybe the prestige of the unit is kind of decreasing, and I don't think we have a lot of information about sort of people from Scandinavia going. I think those sources aren't, you know, that doesn't seem to be the case. So I don't know who's making up the guard at this point, but we know that there's definitely lists of Varangian officers from this period. I think the last even in the early 1400s. In 1402, Emperor John VII writes to King Henry IV of England, And he talked about the defense of Constantinople against the Turks and says that there are English troops helping to defend the city. And he's presumably referring to the Anglo-Varangoi, the English Varangians. Or people who might be called, some of them might be English mercenaries, but there's also what they call Varangopuloi, so sons of the Varangians. So they might be people who were, you know, who were Byzantines, but who could trace their ancestry back to Varangians, who had a kind of a special status. So we don't, I mean, so as late as the early 1400s, there are still Varangians in the Byzantine military. And indeed, there's a reference in 1404 to them being the axe-bearing soldiers. So that they still, whether they're actually still fighting with them, who knows, but that the axe is still kind of the symbol of the Varangian guard as a unit. Which again all kind of seems, I don't know, I think when most of us envision, you know, the end of the Byzantine Empire in the 1400s, we don't think about any of the defenders of the city being English or being able to trace their ancestry back to English immigrants. But, you know, one of the things that really kind of struck me in this whole project is it's I don't know, I think it reveals this Mediterranean world, particularly the stuff in the 1040s. It's a Mediterranean world that's going to kind of disappear in the wake of the Crusades. Like the political situation will be realigned after that. And it's this Byzantine Empire that's extremely, I don't want to say, it's very, I guess, cosmopolitan. It has forces in its military that come from, you know, really all over the place. You have people like the two other Varangians who are named in Harald's saga, Ulf Ospaksson and Haldor Snorrason, are both from Iceland. You know, so in this Byzantine invasion of Sicily, you've got people who are from Iceland, you've got people who are from like Russia and Ukraine, you've got people who are from Italy, people who are, you know, Italo-Normans, some of them might be even from Normandy. You've got Armenians, and, you know, fighting against people from Sicily itself, from North Africa. So it's you know, we tend to think of that as an era when people don't, you know, people don't travel very much, people don't have much contact with kind of, you know, the outside world. And then here we have, you know, not only people making the journey from Scandinavia to Constantinople, but so many of them that there is a regiment of thousands of them in the Byzantine military, which kind of goes against, you know, even like, and I study this period, but that's still my instinctual stereotype. You know, I still have that instinct that says, oh yeah, how wild and diverse this is, but actually, you know, maybe not.
Yes, that's, excuse me. Excuse me. We'll edit that bit out. So I guess we need to look at it more as the world being more cosmopolitan than perhaps we would think it would be in those ages, with people guessing around a lot more than we think.
I mean, that seems to be kind of I don't know. I feel like we're always surprised when this, and it's just, so there's got to come a point where we're always surprised by these things happening than we think. Because of course I mean, that's not to say that most people were, you know, jetting around the world, and this was seen as like something that was quite daring and adventurous of him to do, but certainly not impossible, you know, not strange, just like, wow, he went that far. But within a context where, like, the idea doesn't have to be explained. It's understood that these, you know, medieval Icelandic readers and hearers of this tale will think, oh yeah, you know, going to Constantinople, join the Varangian Guard. It's a bit like saying somebody joined the French Foreign Legion, right? Like, it's not something most people do, but it's certainly something that happens all the time.
This has been properly fascinating, James. Thank you so much for this. You did tease us earlier about what you're working on at the moment. So is it more Varangians, or what have you got on your plate at the second?
Viking in the Sun is a, this is kind of how I got into the Varangian Guard. I wouldn't even say we're working. I mean, it's done. It's out now. I'm sorry. That's the better way to say it. It's out now. So History and Games Lab, I wasn't that involved in the previous project, but in 20, I want to say 20, put out a book about the Crusades. It's called The Crusader States, and it's not even really about the Crusades. It's about the world of the Crusades, I guess. And that's a supplement for a war game, a miniatures war game called Lion Rampant. So it's called Lion Rampant, The Crusader States. And that was very well received. So did a second one, which is set a little bit earlier than that, called Lion Rampant, A Viking in the Sun. And it's got chapters on Sicily and on the conflict in Italy in the 1040s and on what's going on in the in Palestine around this time, where there's a brief period of very good relations between the Byzantines and the Fatimids. And so it's just the goal of the History and Games Lab to turn historical research into games. I wrote the section on the Varangian Guard, and I wrote the section on the invasion of Sicily. And, you know, I knew about them. I was familiar with the saga sources, much more so than the Byzantine ones. And as I, you know, as I dug into this, this is sort of where I began to think, like, the sort of popular image of the Varangian Guard as, you know, oh, the emperor's got a bodyguard of colorful foreigners, is like, it's true, but it also, it's just a fraction of the sort of interesting connections that you start to dig up when you start to look into it. So yeah, it's called Lion Rampant, A Viking in the Sun. You can, if you just go on Facebook or whatever and look for History and Games Lab, you'll find the History and Games Lab page, and you should like that. And you can find out how to get it from there.
James, this has been brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us. Are you on social media? Can people follow you and so on?
I am. I don't know how much they want to see pictures of my dog, but they can find me on. Everybody likes to see pictures of a dog. They can find me on Twitter. I'm at Gonzo History on Twitter, on Facebook they can see mostly posts from my colleagues, but occasionally things from me on the History and Games Lab Facebook page.
Perfect. And there's nothing wrong with a Twitter career based around pictures of dogs. Bernie and I know many a person who's done very well for themselves out of that. So James, absolutely brilliant to talk to you. Thank you for shedding light for us on the Varangian Guard.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.